from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made last month at Columbia University, where a psychology professor found symbols of hate spray-painted on her office walls. Dr. Elizabeth Midlarsky says she was shocked to see big red swastikas in the room, but at the same time, she said she wasn't surprised to be the victim of such vandalism. 10 years ago, she found anti-Semitic flyers in her mailbox. She also pointed to a recent increase in displays of hatred and bias. Just weeks after the massacre at a Pittsburgh synagogue, the FBI released its annual hate crime statistics report, which showed that hate crimes and acts of violence motivated by intolerance were on the rise. The report showed that in 2017, hate crimes in the United States were up 17%, anti-Semitic attacks spiked 37%. According to the FBI, last year marked the third year in a row that such attacks increased. College campuses are certainly not immune to these issues. At the University of Rochester, students discovered a swastika drawn on a sign at the Eastman School of Music. This hour, we have a conversation about the impact of hate and intolerance on society and what we can learn about the present through events from history. Our guests bring an academic perspective. They have studied the subject. They've studied the psychology of stereotypes and intolerance, historical indicators, and how to talk about hatred in the classroom. We'll welcome our guests now. Nora Rubel is the Jane and Alan Batkin Professor of Jewish Studies and the Chair of the Department of Religion and Classics at the University of Rochester. Nora, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Laura Ellenboss, an Assistant Professor of Psychology. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line with us is Thomas Fleischman, Assistant Professor of History. Thomas, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
I want to say that all three of our guests today participated in a recent podcast the University of Rochester put together, and we will make sure that you can find that through our various platforms, because I think it will inform a lot of this conversation this hour, and I appreciate the fact that they took the time to do that and are willing to sort of follow up on the themes there. But let's just sort of start more broadly here, and I'll start with Nora on this. You know, if you look at Pittsburgh, if you look at this event at Columbia, it is easy to have availability bias and assume, well, these things are on the rise. But the actual statistics show that they are on the rise, that these kinds of incidents of hatred, of hate motivated or intolerance motivated, harassment, violence, sort of intimidation, are on the rise in this country. There's no doubt about that. Is that right?
No, that's correct. The one thing I would say, though, is that what happened in Pittsburgh is an outlier in the fact that it is a physical attack.
Okay.
And while there is certainly an uptick in anti-Semitic vandalism and bias crimes, they tend to be not assault-driven, which I think that if you look at the statistics for anti-Black racism, anti-Muslim, anti-gay attacks, those tend to be more physical in nature. The attacks against Jews tend to be more threatening, swastikas, flyers, mm-hmm. That sort of thing. So the Pittsburgh attack, I think, was devastating for its violent nature and surprising in that way.
Yeah, I take the point, and I think one of the concerns that probably most people in any population who aren't motivated by hatred would have is that if X is the average number of sort of intolerant activity, harassment, discrimination, swastikas, et cetera, in any given year, and Y is the number of actual physical violence and attacks, Y is obviously going to be a lot smaller than X. But the concern is that if X is larger than Y, and it doesn't take a lot of Y, you know, these incidents, to be a really deadly and devastating sort of calendar year, which is what we're looking at here. It takes one Pittsburgh to devastate a country, I think. And the concern is if X is bigger, then we're going to get more of Y. Is that fair?
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, the rhetoric that's been on the rise has not helped the situation at all. I think that what was stunning to a lot of people about the Pittsburgh massacre itself was how it really fell into all of these tropes of, you know, for lack of a better word, old school anti-Semitism, you know, old school European style anti-Semitism. It's very race-based. The kinds of rhetoric that the gunman was spouting about all Jews must die, the Jews are the children of Satan, this goes into a very dark, old history of anti-Semitic racialization of religion.
Laura, what to you is sort of the broader picture of how hate is impacting our society now? Because this hour we're going to talk about the psychology of this. We're going to talk about what happens as we raise our children and what they're surrounded by. But do you feel like, for lack of a better word, things are different now, that things are more charged these days?
Compared to past generations, maybe. But as a developmental psychologist, I often think about the sort of mixed messages that our kids are receiving about religion, about ethnicity, about socioeconomic status. So one of those sources is potentially rhetoric in the media about who belongs in our country and who doesn't, mm-hmm. About who gets to say what in public spaces. So it's important to know that the long-term effects of that will certainly be felt. Attitudes that are formed in childhood are more difficult to change in adulthood.
Well, Thomas, you said on the podcast, the U of R podcast, that you start your class on Nazi Germany with a cliche that history repeats itself, and you admonish students not to view Nazi Germany in that way, but to use Mark Twain's famous expression. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Mark Twain is credited with the witticism that the past doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. And it's from this perspective that I begin my class. When students take it, they generally come to it for a number of reasons. Some are merely interested in the subject of Hitler and World War II. Some want to know more about the Holocaust and how it unfolded. But a growing number are now worried about the prospects of fascism in our own time. So we start with that question, sort of, what was fascism? Is it alive today? And how would you know? And from my perspective, the present is certainly rhyming now and maybe even adding some harmonies too.
Okay, so again, before we kind of dive into some of the specifics, I guess another important broad question is, you put together this podcast from all of your different perspective and expertise to help understand what's happening, but also I'm curious, Nora, what do you want people to do with this information? Because most of our audience listening will agree, not all, but most will agree on how troubling all of this is. The question is, what's a possible prescription? What are you hoping people do as we look at this picture in its totality?
Well, I think that Tom and I both spoke a little bit about this on the podcast earlier, about sort of its historical resonance and how, you know, this is not a new phenomenon, this sort of anxiety about immigration and othering and fear. And it comes up in times of economic crisis and other forms of instability. I think what's important, though, is to call it out when it's seen, call it out when it's coded, call it out when it's a dog whistle. I think that we've let things go too much. And I think that it's really, really important to recognize when these things are starting small. As you said, if X gets bigger, then Y is inevitable. So I think that we need to sort of recognize what's happening and be more vocal about it.
Nora, on the subject of dog whistles, I'm trying to remember. I think it was Lee Atwater, who was George H.W. Bush's mm-hmm. strategist. And the reason that he comes to mind is with the recent passing of George H.W. Bush, there was a lot of sort of a look back at his career and some of the tactics he used in campaigns. And Atwater himself said that he learned how to use language that appealed to white voters that was essentially racist, but coded enough that it was ostensibly not racist, but it appealed enough to their anxiety about race. And hearing Lee Atwater admit that in his life before his own passing made me wonder sort of two things. Number one, why was that not a bigger story? Why do we allow that coding and that dog whistling to happen when it seems often pretty obvious that, oh, you're saying this, but what you're really saying is this? But number two, do we risk sort of in a polite society occasionally misstepping, saying, oh, I see, so this is a racist statement, when perhaps it isn't, or at least it's more gray? Because I think that's probably why people don't call out, unless it's super egregious. I think there's less calling out, as you say, because I think there's a fear of offending one's sensibilities or assuming too much.
Right. And I think Lee Atwater is an interesting thing to bring up. There was a lot of discussion of the Willie Horton ad after George H.W. Bush died. I think, you know, there is this question of plausible deniability and the fear that you're going to call someone a racist. And in some ways, I think there is this response as if being called a racist is worse than being the victim of racism. And I think that I think that maybe the answer is to be judicious about the way you approach it, as opposed to maybe just calling someone out as a racist, maybe saying, why did you say it that way? You know, what do you mean by that? This sounds to me like, and then maybe start a conversation, because then, you know, the person has a moment to say, that's not what I meant. And you can sort of say, well, this is what it sounds like. Can you explain more to me what you did mean? And maybe follow it from there. It's a difficult thing. I think that we all felt this way in the lead up to the 2016 election. I think that there was a lot of interpersonal dynamics that got very, very tough on all sides, not to be on both sides. But I think that you had that on the left and on the right. And after the election, it got worse.
I think that's an interesting tactic to use, not just to say, hey, that's racist, but to say, you know, to my ear, that sounds like what you're really saying is, you know, based in racism or sexism or hatred of some kind. And let them unpack that. Let people unpack that. Mm-hmm. And at least call it out maybe in that. I think that's very interesting. And Tom, you brought up on the subject of fascism. Again, in the, keeping with the theme, Twain's theme, that it's not necessarily maybe combining Twain's theme with Godwin's law, that, you know, the idea that if you invoke Hitler or Nazis, you've lost an argument. Or that the probability of Godwin's law is the probability of the longer an argument goes on as it approaches one, that someone will invoke Hitler or Nazism. But the bottom line is, I think at least to my ear, what you are saying, Tom, is that it's not a perfect repeat of Nazi Germany, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be having conversations about what fascism might look like, what the roots of it are, how it develops, and whether we should be concerned. And on that subject, here is Michael Tracy, a progressive journalist who works for the Young Turks, who just tweeted this morning referring to the passage of the crime sentencing bill, which became a bipartisan effort that is going to reduce sentences often for people who are for black inmates, for Latino inmates who end up in jail for various reasons. This bipartisan bill may actually reduce sentences that were often viewed as unjust. So that has happened this week. And we see the Trump administration talking about pulling out of Syria. And Michael Tracy just tweeted the following. He says, if you've been arguing that ascendant fascism is the most instructive lens through which to view recent developments in our country, maybe now you need to reevaluate. Saying that the crime bill, that pulling out of Syria is an indication that for those who say, well, Donald Trump is, you know, let's worry about fascism, maybe we are overbroad. Maybe we are hysterical there. And Tracy is asking, from the left, is asking us to pull back on that. What would you say to that, Tom?
Well, I'm fortunate enough that I teach a class that is called Hitler's Germany, so I can invoke Hitler whenever I want in the classroom setting. But setting that aside, you know, part of the reason why the expression, you know, history repeats itself is so unhelpful is for two reasons. One, it suggests that, you know, the past is inescapable, which it's not. But on the other hand, it may give us false comfort that since we know how Hitler and the Nazis ended, that we too will overcome it in our time. And what I teach my students is actually to view the past, to view history and to view every moment in the past as always contingent and always open to change, that nothing is fated to be. So what does that mean? It means that on the one hand, just because there is racism and xenophobia doesn't mean that fascism is on the rise and we're in a straight line to the Holocaust. But at the same time, you don't need Auschwitz to have fascism. You don't need World War II to have real harm and violence done to people in the name of this ideology.
Tom, I had a conversation with a professor yesterday who teaches on different subjects, but was recently talking about a book about capitalist, ostensibly capitalist China, and a book that he was reading on what's happened in the last 40 years in China, and a real concern about some dark times possibly ahead there. And what his message to me was, he said, my takeaway is, as rough as I think things have been in our own country, at least we do have a Mueller. At least we do have an investigation. We do have a relatively free press that can investigate and publish not only facts, but opinions from various angles. And that doesn't always happen in other countries. That for now, we are pretty well insulated against that. But he said that's still an incomplete grade for this, because we also have a president who is seeking to undermine those institutions to such a way that they might be sort of invalidated, if not by his own hand, but by public sentiment through his influence. So I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Well, I would certainly say that we have, you know, stepped back a bit from the danger we were in. Certainly, the Democrats taking control of the House is another check on that power. But, you know, in the week before the election, we had a massacre of Jewish people in a synagogue. We had two African Americans who were murdered for being, you know, randomly for being black in Louisville, Kentucky. And then we had the president demanding the abolition of the 14th Amendment, the Birthright Citizenship Clause, which are all right there in the fascist ideological, you know, playbook. And which I guess what I mean to say by all of this, putting it together, is that we are never done fighting for, you know, achieving a just and equal society, achieving freedom and liberation for all people. It is an unending and forever task and struggle, and will always thus be.
Before we turn to the subject of children and what we can learn or what we can think about when it comes to how kids are raised and if kids are sort of insulated or maybe what we ought to be thinking about there, I already have the phone ringing and email flowing, so why don't we kind of work through some of the early listener feedback here, and I'm going to start in Aurora with Ben. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi. Yeah, I need to make this quick. I'm just getting back to work soon, but recently watched a documentary on Netflix called White Right, and it shows a great example of what one of the guests mentioned about having a conversation when some of the coded racism is brought up. And she was on Sam Harris's podcast, Waking Up. And I highly recommend looking into that to learn about how we can have this be an exchange between two sides, a conversation rather than an accusation.
Okay, so similar to what Professor Rubel was saying, it sounds like, Ben, that an accusation shuts people down, a conversation allows for an exploration?
Yes, the accusation brings up the amygdala part of the brain, and then it's just in defenses.
Thank you, Ben, and I'll let you get back to work. It's nice that you're listening on your work break, but, you know, it's also great to listen at work. I don't want to get anybody into trouble. Ben is referring to Sam Harris. His podcast is called Waking Up. I listen to it pretty frequently. I didn't hear that particular episode, but I think, Professor Rubel, it's just an extension of your point that a direct accusation might be so charged that it could shut people down. Dialogue, even if it's tough, can open things up. Yeah?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's never easy. You know, it doesn't make you feel good to have these conversations, but it also doesn't make you feel good to let them go either.
Yeah. How about with family, though? Laura, I want to ask you about that. So every year around Thanksgiving, people joke, oh, Thanksgiving dinner, what are you going to say to so-and-so? And I'm always curious to know what psychologists think that how we should approach family if they are invoking ideas or saying things that may offend our sensibilities. Is it worth engaging then?
I think it's worth engaging for sure. And I'll echo something that Nora said about using sort of I statements to lead into that conversation. So addressing something that someone has said or done or a sort of belief system that you know your family member has from your sort of your own take on it can be helpful. So when you said X, it made me feel anxious about, what my little cousin might think about that, or it made me feel worried for how that might play out in your workplace. Essentially, approaching a difficult conversation with understanding that the person's intention might not be necessarily how you are receiving it can be helpful. So it's worth bringing up in a family context for sure. And I think it's good for kids and teenagers to see adults working through difficult issues. They certainly know that they have peers or family members with different attitudes or beliefs than them. So this is almost, it can be a form of modeling conflict resolution.
Okay. Back to the phones we go. Bernard in Fairport next. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, my simple question is, isn't prejudice a good way to pull groups together? I mean, I think that's what Hitler did, is he pulled his group together by hate of Germans. But it just seems to me that that's what goes on in our society. We get try to convince people that they need to hate something, and then they come together as a group. So if you're going to take somebody out of a group, doesn't that make it very difficult to simply convince them that that thought is wrong because the group is right? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bernard. It's an interesting idea. Let's start with Tom, and we'll ask all of our guests to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, I would certainly say that the primacy of the group is a core feature of fascist ideology. This idea that there is some sort of preeminent or exceptional group within a national political context. So in Germany, it's this sort of Aryan or German identity. But at the same time, the primacy of that group is sort of tied to a belief in that group's own victimization. And usually that victimization is at the hands of some sort of inchoate form of modernity or modern culture, and usually takes the form of specific people, whether they be an internal or external enemy like Jews, who can serve sort of both features within society, or a racial minority, or immigrants.
Okay. Laura?
Well, giving people someone to hate is one way to bring them together, but also giving them a shared goal is another way. So if your shared goal is rejecting people who are different from you, I mean, it's one way, but it's not the best way and certainly not the only way.
Okay. Nora?
I agree with my two colleagues. And I think that, you know, what seems to be happening in this way is that you have these different types of scapegoats. So in the case of Jews, for example, you have they tend to be seen as high status minority groups, so it's a different sort of prejudice that is levied at them in a way that this is a successful group that can then be seen through the lens of conspiracy theories as kind of holding the strings and then bringing in. And so, for example, in the case of the Pittsburgh massacre, the gunman saw Jews as the reason that the caravan was approaching the United States, that the Jews were bringing in the brown people in order to usurp the white people. So you have a different type of othering and prejudice that is bringing people together.
Yeah, I want to unpack that a little bit, because Professor Rubel is referring to not just, I think, Pittsburgh, but sometimes we see in at least in American white nationalism, and probably worldwide in this kind of a movement, this idea, as you discussed in the podcast, that the Jewish people are behind the scenes of everything, pulling the strings, controlling society, and trying to sort of supplant whiteness in America, which they would never do abroad. And that, those were some of the things that the Pittsburgh shooter was espousing. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from a listener who describes himself, Don, as a white nationalist, who said, he says, one of the big drivers I see is the nationalism for me, but not for the thing. I've never met or even talked to a Christian identity person. I'd be interested to know your guest take on Israel's recent nationhood law and how that fits with the leading role that Jewish organizations take in things like promoting immigration and asylum in the United States, which undermines the historical American nation.
Well, it's interesting. I would love to know what your
The emailer, yeah.
Your emailer believes the historical American nation is. There's really never been a good consensus on what that is. Even prior to 1776, there was anxiety that there would be too many Germans coming in, that what would happen, we'll start speaking German. But I think the nation state bill in Israel is an interesting thing to bring up, and I imagine that if we went down a certain rabbit hole, we'd probably never get out of it. But there is a difference in views of nationalism among Jews in America and Jews in Israel. And it also leads to differences on ideas of what anti-Semitism is. There is a lot of opposition to the nation state bill among Jews in America, not by all of them, but you say that probably 75-80% of American Jews consider themselves progressive, vote Democratic, and are pretty opposed to the nation state bill. In Israel, Judaism is seen as nationalism by a lot of people. So anything that's anti-Zionist is, by definition, anti-Semitic, because to be against the state is to be against the Jews, where I think it's a little more nuanced in America. And certainly there are differences on this question of Zionism and what nationalism is.
Let me also read one other comment that he made in his email that I hadn't read yet, and I'll ask all of our guests to weigh in. He writes that, it seems to me that nationalism is like the immune system of a nation. In a healthy nation, you hardly notice it. When the nation is threatened, it gets active. Americans who thought we had a white and Christian nation feel that slipping away, and we are anxious about it. So I'll start with Professor Rubel. He's anxious about a white and Christian nation being eroded.
Yeah, so I guess that's an ongoing anxiety, and he's not wrong that the country is becoming less white and less Christian. I guess the question is, what does that mean, and why is that a scary thing, and what lengths are people like your emailer and other white nationalists willing to take to take their country back?
Sure. And I think one of the things I hear often, particularly among sort of acolytes of, to take one example, Tucker Carlson, who has become sort of a national spokesman for this movement, intentional or not. And I am just not interested in him saying, well, you know, his sort of denial of that. This movement has latched onto his show. Richard Spencer was recently saying exactly that, that Tucker Carlson takes our message to Fox News every night. But, what I hear often is this idea that, well, look at how minority populations have been treated here and around the world. And if we become a minority population, what ought we expect, Professor Rubel?
Well, I mean, there's a deep irony in that question, right? So, of course, you know, minorities are treated badly in America. But primarily by the majority, who are the people that are concerned about becoming minorities. Is that right?
Yeah. I know it just sounds ridiculous because...
I'm just saying,
the laughter you're hearing is not because people don't care about it. It's because it seems so that the solution should not be, well, let's prevent whites and Christians from becoming a non-majority or a plurality and just keep the advantage, as opposed to let's create a society that's actually egalitarian and doesn't oppress people, even if they're not in a majority population.
Right. I mean, I think that all of us sitting around the table and Tom on the line would agree that that's probably the move that we should be pushing for.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're all here today. But, you know, it's clear that groups like the alt-right, like Richard Spencer, I have something here where he said immigration's a kind of a proxy war and maybe a last stand for white Americans who are undergoing a painful recognition that unless dramatic action is taken, their grandchildren will live in a country that is alien and hostile. And so that this is an anxiety. And these are younger people. I mean, this is not, I think that's what's shocking to a lot of us. I mean, I'm using that kind of generally, is this sense that when we saw, for example, the young men, and it was men, marching in Charlottesville, how young they were, how they look like anyone we would see on a college campus, and how angry they are. This is not an old, dying out prejudice, right? This is new. It's being stirred up. It's very concerning.
And so, Professor Fleischman, this is a time where I think some of, again, the acolytes of Tucker Carlson and otherwise would say, well, it's too idealistic to think that societies will not oppress minority populations. The human experiment has failed at that for centuries. We've learned that lesson. That's why we want to, you know, find our own spaces. And obviously, I think that that ignores so many realities. Number one, it is just giving up, and which is a bad idea. Number two, I think populations have already sort of become so intertwined, and there's so much intertwining of a global population that we're not going to separating by whatever category you want to use. But Tom, what would you say to those who would make the point, well, we've always failed at this. We've always oppressed people, and we have to give up on the dream that we will stop doing that.
Well, the first thing I would point out to your emailer is that the nation is a historical construct. No one talked about nationalism or nationality until the late 19th century. And just to point out that this sort of conflation of the nation with whiteness doesn't hold up also across time, that were you to ask someone in the 1850s in the United States what made up the American nation, I guarantee that people would be excluding Irish people and Germans from that national community. So to point out that the nation is a construct, that it is imagined, is also suggests that it is not natural, it doesn't have to be this way, and therefore it is going to go away, and that basically that these things can change and do change over time.
Okay. And Laura Ellen Boss is a professor of psychology. This question of why people sort of come to feel the way they do, I think Professor Rubel is noting that it's really 18 to 34-year-old white men in this country who are the biggest followers of alt-right leadership in this country. It's not just older people. And it starts, I would think, in childhood. And you've talked a lot about this. You talked about this on the University of Rochester podcast. What do we need to be thinking about when we are raising our kids, especially if we are in increasingly isolated or sort of self-sorted suburbs, neighborhoods, school districts?
Mm-hmm. So one major challenge in terms of the development of stereotypes and prejudice in childhood and adolescence is that kids don't often have a lot of opportunities to have positive and cooperative and equal status interactions early on in life with peers who are different from them. And different can mean different in religion, different in ethnicity, different in sexuality, different in socioeconomic status. And there's a nice long line of research in social and developmental psychology now showing that these types of positive, cooperative interactions early on in life is the best way to limit the development of stereotypes and prejudice, particularly if we give kids a chance to become friends, close friends, with someone of a different background from themselves. Friendship already confers a lot of positive effects for social and emotional well-being. It's a source of support throughout the lifespan. But a friendship with someone who is from a different social group from oneself in childhood is the number one way of reducing stereotypes and prejudice about that group. So this is a challenge in a lot of communities because our neighborhoods and often our schools are not set up in a way that naturally promotes or enables those types of interactions and the formation of those types of friendships. So that's a very broad a policy level issue. But it's something that we can be thinking about in our everyday interactions with children too, for parents, for teachers, for doctors, for clinicians, for anybody who interacts with kids. We can be thinking about how many chances do they have to get to know someone who is different from one of these different types of social groups. How many chances do they have to chat with those people after school? How many chances do they have to hang out with those people? Who is your little kid want to invite to their birthday party? When they go to the park or the playground, who do they choose to play with? This is an area where we have a chance to get kids to stop and think a little bit about their choices and an opportunity that we have as adults to encourage acceptance and inclusion in the way that we structure kids' interactions.
Okay, and you also talked a little bit about empathy and how kids develop that. And,
oh, sure.
And the obvious extension on what you're saying here is if they are sort of isolated into sort of like groups mm-hmm. growing up, research has indicated that people as adults have less empathy for people who are different than them. So that probably, again, goes all the way back to childhood. I also hear, though, that 6 is the age of empathy. And I think it's sort of a strange thing to think about as a father of an actual 6-year-old, because the easy thing to do would be to think like, well, now I need to start thinking about empathy, as opposed to, you know, can it be sort of fostered and developed early on? Mm-hmm. What does the research tell us about empathy and when we ought to be thinking about that with kids?
6 is a great age for talking directly about empathy, but it actually emerges a lot earlier than that. Recent research indicates maybe even as early as 2, but it's also something we can cultivate across development. So in developmental psychology, empathy is the broad idea of being able to put oneself in somebody else's shoes, to understand usually the affective perspective of somebody else, what they might be feeling in a situation. So empathy is one of those sort of social cognitive dimensions of friendships with peers of another background. So the way that it works is kids who have a chance to become friends, become close with somebody of a different background than themselves, they are more empathetic across group lines. They have much less anxiety about interacting with people who are different from them, and they're just more respectful and inclusive.
So don't just wait till 6.
Nope, I'd say start as early as you can.
I'm late for our only break, and then I'm going to take more of your phone calls because our phones have lit up here. You're hearing Professor Laura Ellenboss, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Rochester, Professor Nora Rubel, who is the Jane and Alan Batkin Professor of Jewish Studies and the Chair of the Department of Religion and Classics. And on the line with us is Professor Tom Fleischman, a professor of history. And we're talking about the subject of hate, how it develops, historical lessons, and what we all can do about it. Let's get that break and come right back to your phone calls. Coming up in our second hour, if you have been in a bookstore recently, you might have seen a book called Love Like Sky, with the heading Families Change, Love Grows. The author, Leslie Youngblood, is from Rochester. This is her debut novel, and it is a remarkable story for young adults. It's about blended families, the desire to find love, and put families back together when they seem broken. You'll want to hear that story next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. John in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. You would think the United States, after listening to the show, is just the worst country in the world. We have people fighting to come into the country. It's just a little discouraging to listen to some of this talk. But
I mean, that Pittsburgh shooting was pretty discouraging. There's a lot of things that are discouraging.
Yeah, when extreme Muslim extremist at Fort Hood, that was pretty poor too. I mean,
yes.
I mean, it's tit for tat. I mean, we could go back and forth all day long with some of the radical stuff. On the left and the right, but my point is this: you talk about what I'm getting out of this conversation is Trump is a race or has racist followers. I don't think you've called Trump a racist himself, but and there's fascism coming out of this administration, whatever. But what about the Obama administration? My fear from the Obama administration was there was a lot of fascism in coming out of that administration. Look, on this partnership between the media and the left, the media is so biased to the left that it's running cover for, as an example, the Obama administration. One of the biggest scandals in American history, I think, is developing right now, not from Trump in the Russian collusion. It's coming from Obama's Justice Department, his FBI, the CIA, whatever. This is not being reported enough by the media. You've got people like Bruce Orr and Andrew McCabe out of that administration that are under criminal investigation. There was collusion between the FBI, the CIA, the Justice Department against Trump and his candidacy and if is post-election. This is not being reported. Uh-huh. This is really true fascism right there.
How would you define fascism? Let's do that.
Well, a control of by the government of intimidation and just a power play.
Yeah, it's hard.
Over citizens. And let me take it a step further. Talk about racism. We've got the Democratic Party has Keith Ellison, who's second in charge of the Democratic Party, who's an anti-Semite. Tom Perez, who's the head of the Democratic Party, is a supporter of La Raza. La Raza is a racist group. La Raza stands for the race. So this theory that Trump is a racist, Trump people are racist, et cetera, conservatives are racist.
I mean, John, let me just jump in here, because you're concerned that there's a lot there. There's a concern that the intelligence organizations colluded against the incoming Republican president. I mean, Jim Comey.
And there's a lot
Robert Mueller. Hold on. Robert Mueller, Rosenstein. These people are all Republicans. All of those people leading those organizations were Republicans.
Well, David K. Johnston considers himself a Republican, and he's no Republican.
Okay, but
he might be officially a Republican, but
you don't think James Comey,
Republicans in name
Bob
only.
Mueller, you don't think they've been lifelong Republicans? You think they're just like Republicans in name only?
I think that's true. I'm not a Republican. I'm a former Democrat. I couldn't take the Democratic Party anymore, but I'm not a Republican.
Listen, I got to jump in, John. I got to jump in because we have other people who want to come in. And I always appreciate when you call. But if you want to like rip David K. Johnston for saying he's a Republican and then say, well, I'm actually a Democrat. Come on, man. It's just some weird stuff there. And I want to try to at least unpeel what you're saying about Tom Perez and Keith Ellison, who I think Keith Ellison, the reporting on Keith Ellison, not just possible anti-Semitism, but also some very serious Me Too allegations that I'm glad have been reported. So, but what we're talking about here is hatred. What I don't see is actual racism coming from the Obama administration and the way that you open the phone call. So email me separately, because I think you got a little far afield there. And if you really feel like I missed a point on the Obama administration and racism, kick it my way. I don't see that. But Professor Fleischman, do you?
I study history, and so I get a little unsure when we wade into the present. But I would point out that the things I'm saying today are based on the research of scholars over the last 70 years. Everything I've talked about today has been written about prior to Trump. And so if it's making you feel uncomfortable when compared to Trump, it's probably because there's something going on there.
Okay. Professor Rubel, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would actually add that prior to the most recent caller, I don't believe that Trump was mentioned at all by name in the first 45 minutes of this conversation. So it was the caller that brought him up and so clearly saw something going on there. And I would like to say something quickly about Keith Ellison, which I'm not going to wade into the Me Too stuff at all, but I think that he has a lot of Jewish supporters in his district that would claim other to these arguments of anti-Semitism. I think that he's been unfortunately smeared quite a bit.
Okay, and I don't have any expertise on that. I mean, I've been trying to follow as best I can. But again, we were a little far afield. And let me say also to John, if my response came off as rude to you, John, I apologize. Please email me separately. I am trying to follow a lot of different threads you were kind of weaving there. So, but I want to keep the subject on hate, which is why we're here. And let me get back to your phone calls. This is Shaheen next. Go ahead, Shaheen.
Hi. You were earlier talking about accusation versus conversation. I totally agree with you, of course, that conversation is better than accusation. However, I want to say that we have a tendency to always put the burden of that empathy that we talked about on the shoulder of the victim. I'm not supposed to, as an immigrant, get upset with someone who says the most racist things to me. I have to understand that they have this quote-unquote anxiety about their country becoming less white and less Christian. At what point in this conversation do I call that so-called anxiety its true name, which is racism, and make the person aware that this has racist colors in it? Do I become like a therapist and dig in their past and have continuous conversation with tons of patients until they possibly understand what mm-hmm. we are saying? Because mm-hmm. I've tried this. And it seems it's extremely hard for somebody who's been attacked by racist comments to take the higher responsibility, and for people who open their mouths and say whatever they want to whoever, if less white and less Christians in this country have contributed to the greatness of this country. So if you want to throw them out at this point and call them all kinds of names, it's painful enough that sooner or later they're going to call you on it.
Yeah.
Don't you think so?
Yeah, Shaheen, thank you for that. So just to clarify one point, and I appreciate the phone call, and then I'll turn it over to our guests. The emailer in question in this case identifies himself as a racist and says that he believes that he is proud of being white, he's proud of his race, and he is concerned about the decrease in the white population in this country. Interestingly, when the Tucker Carlsons of the world say that, or when they call immigrants, you know, when they say immigration makes this country, quote, dirtier, which is why Tucker Carlson is losing sponsors this week, their followers will express the exact same concerns as I read in the email, but then say, well, I'm not racist. The interesting thing is this emailer actually says, I am. So what Shaheen is asking, and Professor Rubel, you kind of talked about this, so I'll follow up with you here. What Shaheen is saying is, how do you work with that when people say these things, which are exactly what are being espoused by leading racist organizations, but then they say, but I'm not racist. I'm just concerned about this.
Right. So first of all, Shaheen, I would say thank you for calling. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like, I don't think that the labor needs to be on the person that's being attacked. I think that that's, you know, not your job. But I think that when we were talking about the discussion or the dialogue, it was more about, you know, when someone says something kind of in passing, how do we deal with this? And I think this is more of a something that allies need to do. So because often we hear things and are assumed to be in agreement. And I think that that's really, really important to speak up when you hear things like that, that are maybe not directed to you, at you specifically, but are directed at others. And I don't know.
Okay, well, no, I mean, I think Shaheen, I think is, I could hear her frustration there.
Right.
And just sort of dealing psychologically with people who are really ingrained to say really harmful or difficult things, but then claim some sort of veil of, you know, you can't call me a racist, you can't say this.
And I think you can when there are certain things like, you know, I think saying that immigration makes this world, makes this country dirtier is pretty clearly racist. But I don't know. I mean, it's a fine line. There's a point where you just get fed up with it. And I mean, I think it's a difficult call.
Down our last couple of minutes, a couple of listeners have directed me to a tweet that has 15,000 likes from Amy Siskind, who is a journalist and a commentator, who recently tweeted, quote, I will not support white male candidates in the Democratic primary. And it got a lot of love for that. And now I'm hearing from pushback from some white listeners who say, hey, that's racist. Well, Professor Fleischman, is that racist? Should we be concerned about that mentality?
Oh, man, it's a tricky question to answer. I would not call that racism. I would call it trying to promote voices that haven't been heard as much.
Okay, Professor Ellen Boss, how do you view that?
Yeah, I want to signal boost a couple of things that Tom and Nora said, and that the responsibility for managing and trying to reduce racism should not fall exclusively on the shoulders of people who are targeted for discrimination. So, we should be calling it out, and we should be thinking when we're doing that about the approach that we take and if we would want to see our kids doing that with their friends and the people in their school tomorrow.
Okay. And Professor Rubel.
I would echo my colleagues and say, yes, I think this is a, I wouldn't call it racist either. I mean, I think there's an element of power that is inherent in racism. And I think encouraging the voices of others who have been marginalized is not racist.
I want to tell our listeners one more time that the podcast that got our attention came from the University of Rochester, and we will link to that in various platforms if you want to hear them discuss some of the things we couldn't even get to this hour. And your phone calls, your emails are always appreciated. Listeners, couldn't get through all of them either this hour, but it just goes to show you we could probably talk an hour a day about the subject of hate, the roots of hate, how to deal with it, its many layers. And I want to thank our guests for taking the time to help lead that discussion this hour. Professor Nora Rubel, who is the chair of the Department of Religion and Classics and the Jane and Allen Batkin Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Rochester. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Laura Ellenbus, Assistant Professor of Psychology. Thank you very much, Professor. Thanks for being here. And our thanks on the phone, Professor Tom Fleischman, who's Professor of History. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections is coming up.